All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Hey there, this is Anish Majumdar, career coach. Get ready for something transformative with Aubrey Johnson and The Road to Rediscovery.
Our lives are laid out on a road of bumps, turns, struggles, and more. How do we respond? How do we endure adversity for learning and growth? I'm Aubrey Johnson, and we'll explore these questions and more on The Road to Rediscovery.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Road to Rediscovery. I'm your host, Aubrey Johnson. The Road to Rediscovery is about reflecting on life lessons to learn and grow from them, and of course, pay it forward and help others who are struggling through dark times. Now, as you know, on The Road to Rediscovery, we are very, very, very focused on delivering quality content that is of value to you and your personal growth. If you like what you hear, please visit roadtorediscovery.com/donate. That's road, the number two, rediscovery.com/donate. We'll give you a shout out in a future episode. And as always, there is no obligation. We are truly, truly grateful for your listenership. My special guest is a religious trauma survivor who was raised in a Christian cult and endured religious trauma abuse. He's part of the LGBTQ plus community and has thrived in pursuing psychology to help other survivors. He's a coach, podcaster, writer, content creator, and activist. We're going to hear about his tremendous journey and learn what he means when he says, "You are your own hero." Ladies and gentlemen, let's please welcome Andrew Pledger to the show. Hi, Andrew. How are you, man? Welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
I am doing good. I am so excited for this, and I am so grateful that you are having me on today.
Oh, thank you. We're equally grateful for your willingness to come on to the show for sure. So, Andrew, I want to just start off by, if you can help us out by understanding, okay, what is the differentiator between, you know, that makes a Christian cult or religious cult versus, say, a community or congregation that you would see in any everyday church?
Yes, I think this is a great question, because there can be a lot of confusion between the two. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, we have some research out there to help people distinguish between what is a cult and what is a religion. And, you know, we have Stephen Hassan's BITE model and Lipton's criteria for thought reform. And these are two of the models that I used to really analyze the background that I grew up in. And so Stephen Hassan's BITE model, which stands for behavior control, information control, thought control, and emotional control, and all these different aspects of that. So how far is a group going to control your behavior? Mm-hmm. How far are they willing to control information you're exposed to, and also the environment that you're in? And do they discourage a lot of critical thinking? And do they tell you how to interpret your emotions? And those are general things. And through Lipton's criteria for thought reform, that really helped me get a lot of the specifics. And for people who don't know my background, I grew up in the independent fundamental Baptist cult. And I'm just going to be talking about from that example, from my experience, when I realized that was a cult. And one of the things that stood out to me was part of Lipton's criteria is called sacred science. And it's when the group claims that their way is the only way. Mm-hmm. And in the IFB, they claim that the King James Version of the Bible is the only legitimate Bible, that all other versions are false or influenced by Satan, and that their interpretation of the Bible was the most correct and anyone who didn't agree with them was a lesser Christian or not quite right with God yet. So they took this very extreme approach to that this is the only way, and even like demonizing other Christian denominations within, you know, that religion. And that's something that has really stood out to me as I left, seeing and looking back how much they demonized other Christian groups and Christian denominations who did not agree with that. And, you know, another aspect of that Lipton's criteria is this demand for purity, or in Lipton's criteria, it's like you have to follow the group's rules perfectly. Or there's some kind of consequence for it. You know, you either have to confess to someone or go to the altar or feel so much shame about it. So it's this constant cycle of I feel so much shame and guilt for not doing everything perfectly for what the groups tell me. So it's just this cycle of, oh, okay, I feel good because now I'm following the group's rules. Oh, well, now I'm not. I feel so much shame and I feel broken. Oh, no, I have to get right again. And just it happens over and over again. And the IFB really thrives on fear, shame, and guilt. And it uses this to control people. So they loved fire and brimstone sermons to really scare people so much. And constantly talking about the end times. And it was interesting because they had the answer. They told you they had the answer to get to heaven and you could feel secure, but they would always make you doubt it. They would always make you doubt it to keep you dependent on the group. And looking back, I see that if you didn't agree 100% with the group, if you didn't love their teachings or agree with it completely, then that was a sign that you possibly, you know, you were going to hell. And just hearing so many graphic messages from such a young age was a big part of my religious trauma, honestly. And sadly, children are broken down really at such a young age in this specific environment. But I think it can be hard for people to look at a group and be like, is this a religion or a cult? So I think a big thing to look for is, what is the reaction to the person leaving the group? How are they treated once they leave the group? Is there a smear campaign? Are they shunned? Are they cut off from everyone? Are they the other? And that's another common sign. It's this extreme us versus them mindset. We can't trust people at all outside the group, and we can't socialize with them. And, you know, we're the ones in the group. We're saved. We're right. It kind of has this superiority complex to it. So I think that is a big indicator. And there are healthy religious environments. And that's something I didn't experience until my college years, which is really strange to me.
Yeah.
And I'm going to talk about just a little bit because, you know, when I finally found a healthy church in my college years, it was the exact opposite of what I grew up in. And it was really weird to me going to a church and actually feeling love and community and feeling safe, not having all this screaming and yelling and constant putting down and hateful messages. It was like genuinely love, like Christ wanted. Anyways.
Yeah.
So it was really strange to me, but I think it was good for me to experience that because I had to get this very narrow idea of what a Christian meant, because that was my experience with it. So I needed to explore other ways that people do it or different ways that people see it. And that's just a quick little rundown of the differences between a religion and a cult.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Andrew. I really appreciate that because I think that really clarified a lot of questions I know that I had, and I'm sure that our listeners have. And so there's two things I want to know. First off, I want to know, because of the abuse and the trauma you went through in this Christian cult, and then making that transition or taking that chance, that step to a healthy religious community or a healthy congregation. Was there any degree of nervousness, or not skepticism so much, but maybe fear and nervousness from what you've gone through initially into thinking that it could possibly be the same in this environment?
Yeah, it's interesting. Just for a little context for people, I did this, I changed to a different kind of church in my college years, and I was at Bob Jones University. Okay. So this is when I did that. And also for context, I was also homeschooled my entire life for the purpose of indoctrination, and was exposed to a lot of fundamentalist Christian propaganda. Mm-hmm. So that definitely also played a big role in that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, while at Bob Jones, it was crazy to me because I was not, the church I changed and went to in my college years, I wasn't even allowed to go to Bob Jones University standards. And it was funny, and it was that made it scary that I was going to a church I wasn't even allowed to go to, but I wanted to experience progressive Christianity because that's something I had never been exposed to.
Right.
And I was genuinely curious. And yes, I was really nervous about it. And I tried to, you know, emotionally prepare myself, and I was pleasantly surprised. And even though it was a healthy environment, there were still things in it that were triggering, phrases that were triggering to me, songs that were triggering because of the trauma my mind and brain had associated with those experiences. And so, yeah, it was really scary, but I'm glad I took that chance because that's how I was able to connect with people outside of that fundamentalist group because I had to get out of that environment. So that was nice for me to connect with people outside of this environment and honestly just have a place where you can actually belong and feel safe. And that's so important to us as human beings. We need that. And that was a need that wasn't fulfilled growing up. And it was great to be able to find that in a healthy religious environment.
Very nice. Very nice. And I'm glad you took that chance as well, you know. And I think one of the driving forces in you taking that chance is curiosity. You know, and I think it's important for us to be curious and to remain curious throughout our lives, because in my background, I always have the mindset that I'm always learning. We don't know everything. Yes. We don't have everything figured out. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. So I wanted to see if you could share with us just some examples of the trauma that you reflected on or knew or felt that you were going through, you know, at the time you were trying to make the decision to separate yourself from this group. I guess using the BITE model, examples of abuse and trauma you've gone through that may have had an impact on your emotions or on your beliefs and so forth?
I mean, I think probably the first memory I have of a kid of that religious trauma is I think I was around 7 or 8 years old, and there was a guest preacher at the church I grew up in, and he told a very horrific, graphic sermon on hell. And I had never heard such a descriptive. It was just all the graphic things he would talk about, how demons would do all these things to you. And then to have my parents reaffirm that. And I was so, so scared of that. And I struggled with nightmares from such a young age.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, coming home from that church service and just not being able to sleep. And I was just so scared because, you know, I was given all these horrific images and ideas of hell, and also being told that, you know, being described to these horrific spiritual beings or demons that are around me constantly and are constantly messing with my thoughts. And I'm like, can I even trust anything that's happening in my mind, or am I being influenced by this or that? And, you know, my mom came into the room And, you know, she showed me the plan of salvation that the IFB taught.
Okay.
And it was like, admit that you're a sinner, believe that Jesus died on the cross, and confess your sins. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's like, oh, once you do that, you'll be fine. There's no need to worry. And, you know, once that happened, that did calm me for a little bit. But, you know, there's always that, they would try to plant that seed of doubt in your mind that you possibly weren't saved.
Yeah.
If you didn't follow these certain rules or do these certain things. So that fear was kind of always there. And the idea that spiritual warfare was constantly happening, it kept you in like a state of hypervigilance, I guess you would say. And to me, that was the first memory of that. And I think, you know, in addition to that, basically being taught from an early age that you were so wicked, you were so depraved, there's nothing good inside of you. Mm. It's really harmful, especially like for developing children.
Yeah, right.
Developing children need to build healthy self-esteem.
Yes, yes.
But what I've realized looking back on the IFB, it was never about what was doing best for children or what was healthiest for children. It was about what could break the child down, mm-hmm. and what could make them conform to this ideology, and what will make them grow up and stay in this group and continue to push this idea. It was never about what was best emotionally or psychologically for the child. It's about obedience and conformity. Yeah. That was the priority for them. And so in addition to that, I had these teachings reinforced at home, and, you know, homeschooling and then at this cult I grew up in, the interaction between both of these had a big impact. But I mean, there were times growing up, my parents really used religion to control and abuse. I remember being told from a young age, and this is an instance that I remember, that I was basically, I wanted like a candy bar from the store because I did something good. And I'm like, oh, well, I did this good thing, so right. I deserve this. Right. I accomplished something. And I remember my mom being really harsh, and she was like, oh, no, you don't deserve that. You deserve to burn in hell for eternity. That's what you deserve. So it was just such a harsh reactions like that from a young age. So I think I learned very quickly early on that I could never be loved or accepted for really myself, that I had to conform to this ideology and people please in order to get the praise and the esteem I at least tried to get as a child. And, you know, other things, my parents did have a lot of very harsh physical punishments growing up, especially my father. Right. And so, you know, me and my brothers lived in fear of like messing up or making mistakes, mm-hmm. afraid they would get physical punishments. So we really walked on eggshells a lot. We learned not to have like show our emotions. We learned not to have opinions about anything, and just kind of keep quiet, conform, and just obey. And, you know, no problems were addressed in my family at all growing up. So there was just, you know, a very toxic family dynamic. And, you know, and especially like even at home and at church, hearing so many hateful messages about the LGBTQ plus community did have a major impact on me once, you know, I was aware of my own sexuality and like the confusion. Because I was taught that it wasn't, or that I was taught that it was a choice, but I wasn't experiencing it that way. So it was really confusing to me. And, you know, for the longest time, I didn't think I met their criteria of, you know, their version of sexuality, because it didn't meet their extreme view. Mm-hmm. But once I really learned about sexuality a little bit, at least, and understood, it was hard, because when you're told over and over again, you know, that God, like, you're an abomination, really. And is in that environment, it's like God hates, like, has this special hatred for you. That's worse than anything else in that environment. And, you know, that really, especially, you know, from that young age, it really destroys your self-esteem. And, you know, growing up, I did find comfort in believing there was a higher power that cared about me somewhere.
Right.
Even though that message wasn't always consistent, it changed. That was another thing. The kind of love bombing that happened in that environment is that sometimes God seemed like this amazing, loving being. And other times it seemed like he was so angry and hateful, wanted to destroy you. So I was just really confusing.
Sure.
From such a young age. And it's just a lot of that, just all those messages, all those years, just being internalized, you know, with the very anti-LGBTQ plus things, just completely just having you deny your own humanity.
Right,
and
right.
Have you feel shame for it.
Mm-hmm.
And at times that there were a lot of, you know, even if my church had a Christian camp, like there were a lot of psychologically abusive messages. Like I remember as a, you know, in elementary school at that age, going to this Christian camp, mm-hmm. and having these adults tell me that, you know, I better share the gospel with anyone and everyone that I can, or I could be the reason that someone burns in hell for eternity. Mm-hmm. And having just, again, this fear, shame, and guilt through all these different kinds of messages that really, they really break you down as a person, and they don't let you, you don't really get to form your own identity and sense of who you are, and you're disconnected from your body, your thoughts and emotions. So you're really under their control. Mm-hmm. And the thing with mental health, when I started struggling with mental health in my teen years in this group, there's a lot of shame and blame on that. So in addition to that, you know, if you're struggling with mental health, it's because you're not conforming to the group's rules, or you're not praying enough, or you need to read the Bible more. And so I learned to try to hide mental health symptoms, which of course made them much worse. And, you know, I did struggle a lot with depression in my teen years, horrific depression. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where, like, I couldn't hide that anymore. And my parents didn't know what to do, and they really didn't handle it well at all. There was a lot of shame and blame,
right,
around that too. It of course made me want to hide it more. And, you know, there were all kinds of trauma responses that happened to help me adapt and deal with that. And so in these situations, you know, because I couldn't physically escape, the freeze response was usually most common to me. And for people who don't realize what that is, a freeze response in that kind of situation is when you disassociate.
Right.
Your mind basically, or consciousness in a way, leaves your body, or part of you leaves it. And like, you're trying not to feel anything,
right,
in that moment, and not feel those emotions or those experiences. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, disassociation was a common thing for me. And the fawn response was another one, which is just, is people pleasing, but to the point of like, you're not taking care of any of your needs. You're not considering that you have needs at all. It's just constant giving and doing things to people please, to feel like you have worth and that you are worthy, and that your worth is kind of sadly based on that. Mm. You know, and there are different mental health symptoms that, you know, my mind and body were trying to communicate to me that something is wrong. But since I was taught to have such a distrust of that, I didn't know what was going on. I'm like, oh, this has to be Satan. I just had to resist, and
yeah.
Everything will be fine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did struggle a lot with that through my teen years, and getting into college years, it didn't really get any better, because Bob Jones has his roots in fundamentalism. And there were a lot of spiritually and emotionally and psychologically abusive messages that I had to be subjected to while I was still there. And the constant like indoctrination, and while I was there, and the pressure to do so many things and stay busy at Bob Jones was very overwhelming, and triggered a lot of more triggers, you know, from the environment I grew up in. Mm-hmm. And so while at Bob Jones, probably like, I think it was around midway my college career, by my sophomore year, I discovered the term religious trauma, and was understanding that, you know, this is trauma from a lot of the abusive messages mm-hmm. I was subjected to in, mm-hmm. you know, in these religious environments. And, you know, that was a lot for me to even realize that, oh my gosh, the thing I know they've been trying to indoctrinate me with all these years, it has caused so much harm. Having that realization wow. all at once is just, it's really a lot to deal with and really process. And for me, I just kind of repressed that and put that aside because I sure. didn't want to deal with that sure. in that moment. Mm-hmm. And really, that's kind of, that was the moment, I guess, that I really started on my journey of like deconstructing and questioning the background that I grew up in.
Very nice. Very nice. And that was a defining moment in your life, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Andrew, I can't begin to imagine the odds that you were up against as a child when, you know, usually you leave the house and go somewhere like school or friend's house or something, and you get chastised, your esteem is attacked, mm-hmm. your confidence is attacked, and you can always find, you know, peace and solace at home where mm-hmm. your parents reassure you, no, you are of value, mm-hmm. you are worthy, you are, you know, meaningful mm-hmm. to people. You're important, you matter, you know? But it really sounds like there was fire and brimstone in the teachings. And mm-hmm. If you don't do this, you're gonna burn in hell. And if you do this mm-hmm. and this, then you're reconciled, but only for a little time. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, just again, attacks on your self-esteem during mm-hmm. those formative years, right? They're called yeah. formative years for a reason, because mm-hmm. you're forming, yes. you know, your confidence, your identity, who you are, mm-hmm. your self-esteem. Yeah. And so that takes a beating emotionally, mentally, yeah. psychologically, and then to come home for that solace and reassurance from the parents, and your parents are basically affirming what you heard in those teachings. So that leaves you almost with nowhere to go, you know. I really want to thank you for sharing and giving us a glimpse into your experiences with the abuse mm-hmm. and what type of abuse that, you know, mm-hmm. that was. So that really opens the eyes and ears for the listeners. Now, mm-hmm. one of the questions I had for you, Andrew, was I'm sure there's common themes in these Christian or religious cults, like the BITE model, right? Mm-hmm. Do they take a stronger presence or influence over your beliefs, your thoughts, your emotions, etc. Mm-hmm. To help determine, you know, is this what I'm in? You know, I wanted to know if there's another common theme in these groups. You mentioned a strong us or an extreme us versus mm-hmm. them type of you know approach. Mm-hmm. And so is there another common theme in these groups in which there's one central figure who is I'm really trying to stay away from the word prophet, but just one influential
I know what you mean. Yes, like the leader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that may seem mm-hmm. to believe more of what, I guess, giving himself credit for what he's teaching versus a higher power. Mm-hmm. Is that a common theme as well, or not?
Yes, that is definitely a common theme, and that was something I too questioned in the environment mm-hmm. I grew up in, was the devotion. Mm-hmm. And really obsession that people had with the pastor in my church. Mm-hmm. And this was a red flag to me in my teen years when this happened. I didn't know how to deal with it or label it, but mm-hmm. I remember there was, you know, a member of the group who was praying in the pulpit, and they were praying to Jesus or God, and they were like, "Dear God, help us to be more like Brother Bobby." Mm-hmm. And that really stuck out to me, because we were, you know, there were moments they taught us to be more like Jesus, but then again, this member just prayed, "Help us to be more like our leader." Mm-hmm. And the obsession that people had over him, and even my own parents, they would just get so emotional, and they would actually at times get upset with me because I wasn't enamored at all with him. I didn't have this extreme admiration or devotion to him that they did. And that's why I think my parents stayed there so long, is that this devotion that they had to him. And, you know, looking back, another red flag was when people left the environment, I would hear my parents say things like, "Oh, I can't believe they left. Like, they're not devoted to Brother Bobby."
Yeah.
I was like, "Brother Bobby," I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Like, oof. And the way they would talk about him, it was like he was Jesus himself. And honestly, and I get what you're saying, there's this charisma about them.
Right.
And, you know, and it's interesting because I remember when he died, my parents were saying, they said, "Oh, that was the last great Christian that we had on this planet, and he just died."
Wow. Yeah, that's a red flag, you know. And you know, with these types of leaders, I'm a huge believer of energy feeds off of energy. And so, you know, as this leader, having the charisma, conveying that energy, and I'm not saying it's good or bad energy, but conveying the energy to draw the attendees or to draw the people in the community to this person, you know, and then of course that energy from the people that are drawn to him or her, they feed off of that and start to believe that they're the ones delivering the message and not from a higher power. So, so it sounds like energy fed off of energy in that case. And I guess in a lot of cases where religious cults have this type of, you know, recurring theme. Andrew, I'd like to now just quickly pivot to see if you can give us a glimpse into some of the great work that you're doing to help others who may feel or have doubts or think that they could possibly be in a religious cult.
So kind of about the work that I've been doing is really telling my story to encourage others and encourage them to speak up. And that's why I started my podcast, Speaking Up with Andrew Pletcher, to have people, like, give them a platform to tell their stories and to encourage other people to speak up. But, you know, if someone is listening and they have doubts or is wondering if they're in a cult, I would suggest not being vocal about that to members in the cult, because that is never ends up well at all. There's usually a lot of shame and blame around that, or, you know, like, "Oh, you're not good enough. Oh, you're not, you know, trusting the leader or the group enough." And so I think the thing that makes it really hard, I mean, if you are even questioning your group, that's a great thing, sign for you personally. Because people who are indoctrinated into a cult never think they're in a cult at all. They never do. Not until some kind of awakening happens, some wake-up call happens. So if you're even questioning that, I think that's a good sign that you still have your critical thinking skills and you have a sense of identity. But I would say to people who are questioning, you know, there are plenty of cult podcasts online. You can hear other people's stories too and see similarities and learn. You can research online the criteria for a cult, like Stephen Hassan's Bite Model, Lipton's criteria for thought reform, and understanding that. And, you know, leaving a cult, it's not easy, because it's your whole world and it's purposely set up that way. You're so dependent on the group, you know, your family is in it and your friends are in it. And at times it's your school too. And there's just so much playing into it, and you don't have, unless you learn to secretly network, which is what I did. I had to secretly do that, but in order to get out. But while you're in that group and you find out that it is a cult, or you're realizing that, you know what, this is not a healthy environment, I need to find a healthier faith community, or if you want to leave it altogether, that's fine. Only you know what is healthiest or best for you. So learning to tune into your intuition, which I know is easier said than done after that indoctrination, but a lot of what I do since leaving that cult is, you know, sharing cult information and education, bringing awareness to religious trauma, and, you know, talking about what is a healthy religion or healthy environment and what's not, and teaching people general psychology to help them learn to know really what they need in order to psychologically thrive and grow as a person.
Very nice. Very nice. So you're helping to transform lives and really impact others by sharing your story, spreading the message. And it's that's tremendous. Those are tremendous efforts that you're doing, broadening the awareness, right? That's very important. It took a lot of awareness on your part to kind of determine, okay, what is this I'm going through? Why is this taking a hit on my esteem, my, you know, why is it taking a hit on me psychologically? And and that takes a lot of self-awareness and a lot of motivation, because what you're diving into and what you dove into, Andrew, is not pleasant, but you have to go through that murkiness of unpleasantness to find the fresh flowers, so to speak, the fresh smell, the fresh scents. So you come out on the other side, you know, a transformed person and equipped to transform others. So, Andrew, this is absolutely wonderful. So can you share for, absolutely. I appreciate and commend you for the work that you're doing in helping people, first off, determine whether or not that's the environment they're in. And then secondly, by sharing your story and giving them visibility to resources, helping them determine how, you know, how to get out. So, Andrew, how can the listeners learn more about you, follow you, and even subscribe to your, subscribe to your podcast?
Yeah. So I'm very active on social media. Just look up Andrew Pledger. And I'll give you a link too for the show notes. I have like basically a link tree, a lot of, links to my social media, my podcast. I try to make it so it's very easy for people to find things. But yeah, I on my website, I have a section of a lot of free resources for people to look into that are in different sections that really they're resources that helps me. And I've been like collecting them, trying to put them together for other people to find so they don't have to take so long to find those resources. And really, that's what I hope to that people will look at, and that will help them on their recovery journey.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, we'll make sure and put those links as well as the link to your podcast in the episode show notes so that our listeners can click those links as they are listening to this wonderful episode and in this wonderful conversation to see those resources and to subscribe to your show. So Andrew Pledger, once again, sir, a true pleasure having you on the show. I hope we can stay in touch, and I just wish you continued success in impacting and transforming, you know, others, you know, from such a traumatic experience. Thank you for coming on the show, Andrew.
Of course. Thank you so much for giving me this platform, and I have greatly enjoyed coming on your show.
Oh, thank you. We enjoyed having you here. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in and listening. And look, if you have a neighbor, a loved one, a colleague, who seems to be going through dark days, they just don't see themselves. They're in a dark place, not quite sure where to turn or who to turn to. I humbly ask that you please share this show with them, because on the road to rediscovery, there are two things we want our listeners to know. Number one, you're not alone. And number two, there is always hope. The road's rediscovery. It's a movement, a revolution. And guess what? You are now part of it. We're all roadies on this journey of life, and it sure feels good having you on the road with me. Thanks again for listening. We'll chat again soon.
We really hope you enjoyed this episode of The Roads Rediscovery. We'd love to hear from you. Shoot us an email at roadsrediscoverypodcast@gmail.com and leave us any questions or comments you may have. The Roads Rediscovery is an AJ Shark production.